The Sedra and Vayiga starts out with Yehuda approaching Yosef and speaking to him, asking him to explain him all that has been going on. He repeated that we really didn't come to marry your daughter, so there was no purpose, like the Medrash says, for you to go into such great detail about the families, and you're accusing us as spies. It's an interesting reason given why Yosef accused them as spies. One of the reasons were that Yosef did not want them to go searching for him in Egypt. So he figured when they first came, they'll spread out in Egypt and they'll go looking for him. They may be able to determine what happened to him, and he wasn't ready yet to reveal himself. So therefore, he said, he had diplomatically figured if he'll accuse them as spies, so they'll say they're innocent, but at least they will curtail their activities and they will be afraid to go snooping around. So in that way, he would be able to stop them from eventually determining what happened. Yehuda speaks in different languages. He says, we told you that we have a brother. So he said, bring me the brother. And we said, we can't bring you. He gave him every detail. And then he said, now that you said, bring the brother, now if we go back without the brother, what will happen? Our father will be extremely concerned. Now you want to incarcerate Binyamin, so let me be in his stead, because I had taken over responsibility that I will return him safe. He says, I can't go back to face the father and having him go through this tragic moment when I come back. So now, really, why will Yaakov Avinu, it says in 31, he'll see that the child is not here and he'll immediately die. V'meis, he'll die. So the question is, why will he die? They'll explain it. I mean, he'll explain that if Yaakov was a righteous person, he'll hear that Binyamin tried to steal a goblet, and he stole the goblet. So he'll say skumtem. I mean, Binyamin's a ganef, so he was caught stealing. Or at least he'll listen to the circumstances. So the Dumna Magid says that's what Yehuda said. Yehuda said, Vahi kireise, ki ein hanar. As soon as he'll look and he'll see Binyamin's not there, before we could even open our mouth, from mace, he will die from aggravation. And this, if you look in the Pusik, that's how it reads. Vahihoya kireise, not kishimo that'll hear that what happened with Binyamin. But Vehoya Kiroso Kienanar, as soon as he sees Binyamin is not there, Vamais, he will fall, out of fright, he will die. And you think back to this because Yaakov Avinu's whole concern in last week's Sedra was with Binyamin, you know, that Shnayim Yolda Liishti, he's the only thing I have left. So it's logically understandable that as soon as they come, his eyes will only search for Binyamin. And if he doesn't see Binyamin, it'll be too late already, Vamais. So this is really what Yehuda said. Now, Yehuda, we always repeat the Gra's intonation on the first passage where it says, Vayigash Elov Yehuda, in sentence 18. It reads that Yehuda went forward, so Vayomer Bi Adoni, and he said, please, my master, let your servant speak. So he spoke with great respect, and as Hurst said out, Ki komocha kifaro, I honor you as a pharaoh, I give you all the respect, and whatever I'm saying to you, it's not because I have a lack of honor, but I would speak to Pharaoh also in that way. So now the Gra interprets the Vayiga Shelov Yehuda, that the trop, the tamim, is kadmo ve'azlo revi'i zarko munach sego. You know, each letter has the tamim, the way it's sung. So you sing it, kadmo ve'azlo v'yigash elov Yehuda revi'i. All right, now, in Aramaic, the trop was given also in Sinai. In Aramaic, the word kadmo means to go forward, to get up, ve'azlo, and to go forward. Revi'i means the fourth son, who was Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. So it says the pasuk kadmo ve'azlo. He got up and went forward. Revi, the fourth son, vayigash elov Yehuda. Why? Because zarko munach segol. He had told Yaakov Avinu that v'chotasi lecho kol hayomim. If I don't return Binyamin, I will be forever considered like an outcast in your eyes. So the expression of kol hayomim, in all days, means not only in this world, but I will also forfeit the eternal world. I guarantee you, if I won't come back with him, that I give up my elam habo. So that's the word of the trup, where it says, zarko, he throws out, munach, to rest, segol, meaning outstanding in the eternal world. Why vayigash elav Yehuda? Why did Yehuda choose to make this impulsive move, supposedly? Why he over the other brethren? Because zarko munach segol, he had thrown himself out, he had cast himself out, munach, to rest, segula, with the chosen people, am segula, meaning his olam habo. He had given up his olam habo, and therefore he felt, out of desperation, so Yehuda went forward and he approached Yosef. Now, the answer of Yosef was, immediately in chapter 45, it says Yosef could not hold himself back. Chapter 45, verse 1. And it says, Vayitein eskolo, he's cried. So what did he do before he cried? In verse 1, he said, everybody go away from me. Hetziyu kol ish me'eloi. He sent out all his entourage and all his associates and his ministers. No one should be there in his presence. Because obviously, if they brought in 12 people, or 10, 11 people, so he had guard. They wouldn't just let 11 strange people who have been accused for the most grievous crimes to come in and stay with the minister without any bodyguards or without protection. So Yosef went ahead and he sent these people out. So why did he say, Vayikra Hetzio, he called, said, call Ish Me'eloi, everybody please leave. And he was the only one. So the answer was, like we spoke in the past, because he did not want to shame his brethren. So the Medrash says here that Yosef risked death. He didn't know, first of all, what the reaction of his brothers would be. Maybe they would feel cornered, they would feel desperate, and he didn't know how they felt towards him. His last encounter with them was not a true expression of fraternal feelings, of brotherhood, so he really endangered himself. But the other alternative would be to reveal their shame in front of the Egyptians. So the same way that the Medrash said by Tamar, that Tamar chose to cast herself in, or to expose herself to be in a fiery furnace, rather than to shame Yehuda publicly, and therefore she didn't name him as the perpetrator of that act, but she just sent the seal and so on, whoever will identify this. She didn't name him. And we said, Mutav sheyapil atzmei letechkif sheno esh, we spoke of, person should cast himself rather into a fire than to go ahead and shame somebody publicly. And from Yosef we see a step further, that Yosef risked imminent danger rather than to shame his brother. And this is a very important lesson. But not only that, if you go back into Yosef's relationship with his father, we find some very interesting ideas which are really quite shocking. It seems that next week's Sedre, we read about Yosef being called to see his father for the blessing. And one wonders that, was there an ongoing relationship between them once the father came to Egypt? Now, on the passage a little bit further, which is in the same vein showing Yosef's concern about shaming his brothers, it said that originally, you know, Yosef had always planned that, or he believed his dreams so far, they seemed to be working out. So he believed that the brothers someday will come down to Egypt to bow down to him, or to, to fulfill the dream. So it says in chapter 47, if you'll note, verse 21, speaking, we would think, a total different subject. There it's speaking about the hunger that the people suffered in Egypt. In verse 20, it says that Yosef purchased all the land on behalf of Pharaoh because the people needed money. They became desperate. They went ahead and they sold their possessions. They sold their land. And it said, after he captured the land, in 21, it says, Ve'asahom hevir osolo arim, mikzei gvul mitzrayim Ve'at Kitzei. Now Yosef went ahead and he removed people from the land. Why? Because if they're going to sell the land and they're going to remain on the land, so they won't feel that they sold the land. They'll just, it's just a mechanical, legal type of a deal, but they won't really feel that they gave the land up to Pharaoh. So in order to solve that, he went ahead and he upset the people, you'd say. He uprooted them from their land. But they do point out in its literal interpretation that he did it. Find Sancheriv, Melech Ashur, in Assyria. When he conquered the world, he did the same thing. He went ahead and he transplanted people from one country into another country. That's why, although there are certain restrictions in the Torah concerning certain nations, when they can intermarry into Klal Yisrael, Egypt and Edom, but they really don't apply now. The Gemara says, because Sancheriv came, who bilbul es kol ha'elam kulo. Those that live in Egypt now are not really the Egyptians necessarily of the time of the Torah, of the early years. So that was what Sancheriv did. And this seemed to have been a very common thing, right? I mean, we see even now, Iraq, Yimach Shmom, when he came into Kuwait. We read yesterday they sent a lot of Kuwaitis to the promised land, you know, the eternal land, and they transported the people from Iraq and they're putting them into Kuwait. And the others, they just dispatched to a different world. But Yosef was very concerned here, and it showed his benevolent spirit. For example, if this entire area was purchased by Pharaoh, so you could take some people from Silver Spring, send them down to Richmond, to Norfolk, to wherever you'll go throughout the area. Or you could take the entire population of Silver Spring and move them into the city of Baltimore, and the entire Baltimore to move them into Silver Spring. The uprooting in that way will be not as difficult for the people, because they'll have their same community, they'll have all their friendships, all their relationships, they'll all be together, but they'll just be in a different geographic, a different location. So literally, that's what the Pasuk says. Ve'asa'om, the nation, the people, hevir oso la'orim, he moved them to, according to Lorim, total cities. It means he moved one city over into another city. Like Hirsch points out, he tempered the edict by arranging that the residents who had always lived together, right? Lorim, Hirsch says, means city-wise. Not two cities, but Lorim, according to their cities. City-wise, he moved them to temper the edict that they wouldn't find themselves strange in this new environment, but they would feel that they are not that, you know, they weren't that uprooted. The old social, he says, communal conditions would remain the same. But the Chazal point out a different lesson, that when the Jews will then come, when the brothers will come with Yaakov to Mitzrayim, so they could always be looked upon as strangers, immigrants, right? And they could always throw up to them that you weren't here in the Mayflower. So in order that they should not be shamed by Egyptian later, so everybody in a sense at that period of time was uprooted. People, nobody was really in their home city, so therefore they can't go ahead and claim to them, oh, you're strangers, you don't belong here. So this was the concept of the American melting pot, really, that people hear from so many different immigration, from so many different lands, that that's why you have liberty, you know, and democracy and so on, which is a very good thought. That But Yosef wanted to guarantee his brothers. So you see, he was so concerned for the shame, the welfare, that the brothers should not feel out of place. In the same sense, he was that sympathetic. Now, going back to this point, we see how strong Yosef was concerned, according to the Medrash, that he was so concerned that the brothers should not in any way, or the family should not in any way be harmed or shamed. Now, the Medrash also says that 17 years that Yosef lived with his father in Egypt, Yosef did not come to his father. Can you picture that? Everybody asks, when he sent for him, you know, Avicha Chola, next week's Sedris, why did he send for him? It seems that he never visited. He never visited him for 17 years. Why? Because he knew that if he comes, the Medrash says, together with Yaakov himself, so his father will start asking him questions. How did you come to Mitzrayim? How did you get to Egypt? So he would have to go and tell him the truth. So he would end up telling Lashon Hara, and he would cause shame to his brother. So to his brothers. So in order not to cause shame to the brothers and concern for the brothers, so therefore, can you picture that Yosef decided It's better for him not to see his father. But only when his father was laying on the deathbed, it says there that the father called him. So we see that was the only time that he came, right? And that's why the brothers became so concerned. It says as soon as the father died, brothers were afraid. Now Yosef is going to what? To take vengeance upon us. Why? Because not only were they afraid, but they were afraid the fact that he probably spoke to the father. And the father already knew everything because he revealed himself to him. So we know the love that Yosef had for his father. Yosef gave up a relationship with the father. Just think. The father gave him over all the Torah, his spiritual basis. How much more could he have received during this year? Like it's 20 years of ruchnius, of spiritual living, that Yosef was ready to sacrifice and to give up from himself. Medrash says that Yosef did not see Yaakov Avinu for 17 years, all right? Because he knew what would happen. That shows you in his Medrash what his greatness. But you really could ask even more so. It was even a greater sacrifice. We say that Yaakov Avinu, they meet each other and say Yaakov Avinu said what? Kriya Shma. And Yosef just fell on him and so on. But Yaakov Avinu read Kriya Shma. So it doesn't say, because it says, how does the Pasuk describe their coming together? It says that he fell on him when they came to Egypt. In chapter 46, verse 29, it said, Yosef harnessed up his chariot, and he went to meet Yisrael, his father, to Goshen. And it says he fell upon his neck, and he cried on his neck. Now, it doesn't say what Yaakov did. It said that Yosef wept. Yaakov, it seems, did not weep. So why didn't Yaakov weep? It's interesting, Yosef, the type of a person, just as an aside, Yosef was, the Lutzkerov points out that you find numerous times here expressing that Yosef cried. He says, a little bit earlier in chapter 45, he revealed himself to his brothers, so it says that he cried. In Miketz, also, when the last chapter, it says he turned away from them and he cried. It says he wanted to cry. He went specially into the inner chamber there and he cried. And here we constantly see the idea that Yosef cried. So what is the purpose of putting in so many expressions? He cried and he cried and he cried. I mean, we know he cried. So he tells us that Lutzkerov said, we see, he says, and it's so true, that a person who suffered a great amount in his life, so even when he ascends to a great position and everything is peaceful and fine and nice, but the tears are always flowing. A person who did not have these difficulties and hardships in life, so he doesn't cry that much. In fact, he's not accustomed to crying, so even when you would think the times demanded the circumstances to cry, he doesn't cry that easily. But one who goes ahead and he's accustomed to cry, you know, it's interesting because crying is not so simple. I mean, I once read actors who have to show their emotions and sentiments say some have great difficulty in being able to cry. That means if they cry, they have to cry authentically and truly, sincerely. It shouldn't be. And that's one emotion and one sentiment that is very difficult for them to express because it probably reaches the deepest depths of the person's spirit and heart and soul. So here it shows you that Yosef, for the smallest thing, he cries. Even when the times are happy and joyful, he cries. Because a person who suffered, so even at the most joyful moment, any times his emotions, it seems, are shaken or moved, there are always tears that flow. The brothers, they didn't cry that much, not at all. So even when they were shaken up and so on, you don't find the expression that they cried. But Hirsch points out a little different. He says, Yosef cried when he greeted Yaakov. Yaakov didn't cry. So some say he was reading Kriya Shma, which we'll talk about perhaps later. But there is a startling chazal, which I just noticed yesterday, he brought down. I never saw it before. Masechtas Kala, it's one of the small tractates that are not really of the tractates of the Talmud, but was added on. So it says the following, that the entire time Yaakov Avinu would not kiss Yosef. And Next week, Sedri, you'll talk to see, it says after Yaakov died, so Yosef fell upon him and he kissed him. But it seems during the lifetime, Yaakov, when he came from Egypt on, and he greeted Yosef, you don't find that he kissed Yosef. So the Gemara says, why didn't he kiss Yosef? Because he says, Yosef is such a handsome young man. Who knows what he did in Egypt all these years? Maybe he didn't conduct himself in the most moral, ethical way when it came to morals. And therefore, he was afraid, Portia, to go ahead and to kiss Yosef. And it says that when the children came, he asked, who are these children? So it says Yosef showed him Exuba. So they always question, what does it mean, who are these children? Yosef showed him Exuba. So he wanted to show him. It seems Yaakov Avinu had in his mind, who knows what Yosef did. Now, if we go that way, we could appreciate the sacrifice that Yosef made in not coming to his father those 17 years. He knew the father didn't kiss him when they met. Somehow the father is estranged from him. It's not bothering the father, who is also wondering, why didn't the father ask for him 17 years? So it seems that the father still had doubts about Yosef. Yosef could have come to the father and explained him and told him nothing to fear. I am your son Yosef and so on, and I never deviated from your teachings. But Yosef gave up that opportunity because, and no matter what the father would think about him, so he shouldn't be in a circumstance where he would have to shame his father, his brothers. And that's really the greatest sacrifice that he sacrificed from everything else. Now the fact that Yaakov Avinu, this goes back to the old interpretation that I was getting, Yaakov Avinu was concerned about Yosef and Mitzrayim. Because, and Yosef knew Yaakov's concern, because when you look back in the beginning of Vayigash in the Sedra, it says Yosef tells them, when they come to him, so what does he say? In chapter 45, he first tells them, after he reveals himself, he first, like Hirsch says, he tells them in verse 5, Al te'atzvu, 45:5. Al te'atzvu v'al yichar be'enechem. Don't let your thoughts go ahead and make you despondent and disturbed. Because really, you may have gone ahead. A person is disturbed, he did the wrong thing. But the fact was, he says, that this was destined by God. You may have acted wrong, but at least nothing happened. I mean, you feel bad you broke somebody's glass, right? Crystal. And you thought that this crystal, oh boy. So she says, no, it's not a real crystal. It costs 99 cents. It's a facsimile. So right, you feel bad that you broke it, but you didn't destroy, you know, the best crystal that there is. So he says, for the ultimate result, he says, you don't have to feel bad because this is clearly planned by God. Al te'atzvu kimechartem, because God made that I should come in order to be able to preserve you. So he concerned for them that they should not go ahead and that... Was Yosef so pristine, so pure that he didn't have any sentiments at all? So in fact, that reason they gave was that he wanted to go ahead before he revealed himself. He went through this entire period of relationship preparing himself for the revelation to see that when he reveals himself that he feels he doesn't have any acrimony or any hatred against them. And it comes out that Yosef says to his brothers in verse 3, Ani Yosef, I am Aed Avichoy. The closest you could have to admonition or an expression of grievance is in these words. Vayomer Yosef Elohi, that Yosef said to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, Aed Avichoy. He didn't tell him, Ani Yosef Achim, I'm Yosef Achichem, your brother. He just said, Ani Yosef Ha'ed Avichoy. And what does it say further in verse 3? V'le'yochlu echov la'anoso, so they couldn't answer him, ki nivhalu miponav, because they became confused. And we'll get back to this verse. After Yosef saw that, what does it say next for the next verse? Vayomer, he said in verse 4, Ani Yosef Achichem, I am Yosef, your brother. So the first time when he said, Ani Yosef, he didn't say, Ani Yosef Achichem. So it seems that he just had to tell them, you're so concerned with the father, Ani Yosef, Ha'ed Avichai, is he still living? And then the brothers, the world just opened up and destroyed in front of their eyes. Ki nivalu mepono. They didn't know what to answer. Once Yosef saw that, so immediately he became closer to them, and he says to them, Kshuno alai, come closer. I am your brother, Yosef. He already puts in the word, Achichem, your brother. So you'll say, and that was the beginning of his, so the little animosity, you will say, that he had to express, only being human, would have come out in verse 3, when he said, Ani Yosef ha'eid avichai. But immediately when he saw the brothers' remorse, that they became so disturbed that they didn't know what to say, so then he immediately became closer to them, and he realized that there is this shame and remorse on their side, and their relationship can continue. And he said, "Ayed Ofzicha." The Beis Halevi explains. He says that when he said "Ani Yosef," he says that he didn't say this in a way of expression like a fraternity, just like he said in the next sentence. But contrary, when he told them that, so they really became ashamed, and he said, "Ayed Ofzichai." It wasn't a question. What's he asking him again? Is the father living? They haven't been back since they came, and they just told him the whole story. So what's he saying? Ayed Avichai, is my father living? So according to the Medrash, it wasn't a question, but it was like a rhetorical statement. Do you say, I can't understand, he says, how my father could live, right, when he thought that I wasn't here? You're going to say that your father can't, Yehuda, if you see Binyamin's not there, he's going to fall immediately, he'll die. Ayed Avichai, I'm the Yosef, and is he still living? And the anguish, and he's still living, so in a sense, he showed them the whole story. So the Medrash says that they were overcome with shame. And not only were they overcome with shame, they realized then, when they heard these words, that they were totally wrong in their understanding of what? Of Yosef. That means the fact that they sold Yosef, they thought all along, till the last minute, that it was right. They may have been overly callous. They may have been lacking, we'll say, when he was crying, lacking sympathy for a brother. But in the basic decision to rid themselves of Yosef, they felt all along they were correct. But when he said, Ani Yosef ha'eid avichai, somehow when they said those words, so when he said those words, they realized, like the Gehenna opened up, they saw indeed how wrong they were. So the Medrash continues, and it says, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu will come and reproach every person, lefim mashehu, when the day of reckoning will come, and we have to stand to the Kisei HaKavo, it says, lefim mashehu, according to what he is. What does that mean, according to what he is? On the day of judgment, they will go ahead and show the person in his own personality how he contradicts himself. For example, the Beis Halevi continues. For example, if a person doesn't give charity, so he'll think that I'm not giving charity because I have very difficulty making a living, and you have, you know, you need money to exist and so on, and for the necessities of life, so I can't be that benevolent to spread out that much money. And although it's really not a true answer, but at least it is an answer to a degree, because if a wealthy person doesn't give charity, you have a greater claim against him than if an average person doesn't give charity. So therefore, his punishment should not be that great. But lefi mashehu, when they start showing that person how he wasted money over here and he wasted money over there, when it involved his own personal desires and his own materialistic wants, so then there was no question to him that he needs, you know, that he doesn't have enough money to satisfy himself. Lefi mashehu. Say, to give charity, not, but you pay an extra $1,000 for furniture, you know, just an extra $1,000 over the original price for just an extra little, that for that you have money. So that's what the idea is, lefim mashehu, the way he conducted his life. And the way we explain that, that's what the Medrash says. O lana miyom hadin, woe for us for the day of judgment, and yom hatochecha. Tochecha means the day of when we are shown and we are admonished. Judgment is bad enough, But the admonishment that you get because of the judgment, that is even worse so. Like also in Pirkei Avos, it says you have to give a din and a cheshbon. Din means a judgment, and a cheshbon is the reason why. The din isn't that bad. I always give the mashal without going to the whole drasha, but the din is very, ask the person, why did you miss mincha Sunday afternoon in December? Right? So he missed mincha Sunday afternoon in December, so the angels are all standing there, right? So he'll say, so is it that terrible that you missed mincha? But if they'll tell the person the reason why you missed mincha that Sunday in December, because the Redskins were playing in the fourth quarter and you couldn't turn off the television set to go say Kedusha. Oh, then he's going to become ashamed already. That's the cheshbon. Cheshbon means the reason why. Din is din. Now, the idea of becoming ashamed, we'll think that it's a terrible thing. But it's one of the midos of Avraham Avinu. It's one of the midos of a Jewish person that the Torah develops in a person. And in fact, they make great emphasis, what I said, the kapora that the sons had when nivhalu miponov, when they went ahead and they couldn't answer Yosef. This was the greatest punishment that they could suffer, that they were ashamed. Now, who were they ashamed for? There was nobody there except them. Who were they ashamed for? What kind of a busha? Normally, we know what a shame is. By the normal situation, shame means that if I'm shamed in front of somebody else, I get honor in front of somebody else. But it's always in front of somebody else. If the person could find the shame within himself, that's already a different thing. Normally, we're not ashamed within himself. The Balai Musar point this out, that in that day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then we say, Miyom HaDin and Miyom HaTochecha. Din means poshet. They're going to tell me that you did this, you're getting this judgment. Tochecha means admonishment. If I go to a judge, and the judge is sentencing me, right? So the judge, when he sentences somebody in court, he reads a 2-3-page statement. And he tells you, Alech HaToyim that you did. And you're this, and you're this, and you're this. So if he ends up and says, but even so, I'm going to give you, release you. So you're so happy, right? Because you had tochecha, you were admonished. At least, I didn't have any punishment. There is no din. But here we're saying the din and the tochecha are pushed the same. The punishment that you get and the shame that you suffer from the tochecha, from the admonishment, is the same. The shame that you suffer is the same as the punishment that you get. Because the busha that a person suffers within himself is the greatest suffering that he could have. And this is what it says, that the brothers were overwhelmed when Yosef told them that busha, this is a description of the busha that the individual will have to suffer in the day of judgment. And there's like almost no way that a person can escape that judgment. There are many different approaches that they use. The approach is that what a person is shown what he could have been. It's an interesting idea. A person is shown what he could have been. We can appreciate this in the age of the camcorders. Like now, wherever you go, your picture is taken, right? If you're a bris, it's all on movies. Everything is on a movie. Now, could you picture that there are movies taken of your life? And they show you your life. It's almost like you can make a TV show out of this. And then they'll take out another film. And they'll show you, this is what your life could have been. So if they show the person, Lefim Mashehu, what he could have been, then the shame becomes so much greater. So they say over a Maisa from the Netziv. Netziv is the great of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Belinda from Volozhin. Netziv of Volozhin is famous. So the Netziv's work on the Torah is called the Emek Dover. We quote it very often. So he said one day in his older age that the Netziv made a party for people. And he said to them the following. He said his joy in this day is so great, probably a birthday, because he says when he was young, his father wanted that he should stop learning in the yeshiva and he should go to learn a trade or whatever it is, a profession. So Netziv says, but I wouldn't do that. I insisted that I'm going to remain in the yeshiva. He says, what would have been if I would have given in to my father, he says. And I would have left the yeshiva and I would become a businessman or whatever it is. So I would live a nice life. But he says, I would have never been able, this was at his old age, to put together the Emek Dover, say, the Netziv, the Sefer that he wrote. I would have never been able to do that. He says, now when I'll come after my Ptira, when I'll come for the Bez Din Shomayla for judgment, so HaKadosh Baruch, these were his words, will take out Mitachas Kisei HaKovid from underneath his throne, they'll take out five, the Chamoshim, with the Emek Dover on it, and he would say, look, you could have come here, you had the power to come here having composed the Emek Dover. How do you come here now, he says, like a simple person. So that's the Pshat Lafi Mashehu, the way, and it's even vividly, this story shows you, it not only a safer, it could mean in anything, in any action, a person will be shown what he was meant to be. And the famous Hasidic statement, they'll never ask Zusha why he's not like so-and-so. They'll ask him, why aren't you what Zusha was meant to be? But the way Netziv says it is so poignantly, and we could really appreciate that. Another example was, they say when Reb Aaron Cutler was a very young boy, he lost his parents, and he was a Yosin. And he already was recognized in the great genius that he was. And his family members tried to get him to go into mathematics, to go to school, to go, you know, away from learning Torah. And the people that talked him into it at that time to remain in learning was Rav Kamenetsky, Zochen Levracha, and Rav Krizovsky, the other. They were a little older than him. And they kept him, what, in the yeshiva. Now, what would the Torah world have been if he would not have been in the yeshiva? I mean, so much so, I was just looking this morning at something. Rav Chaim Eiser, the great, who died just at the advent of war, you know, so when he died, his last words were, that he's happy, he's leaving, and Reb Aaron was a young man, that there's Reb Aaron Cutler who he could leave the world to, or something. That was his last words. So I'm saying this person would have come there, so even if he would have written a book on mathematics, but there is really no comparison, really, of what he could have been. And it's by everybody that way. I mean, it's really, each person has what he could have been. And that's the meaning of the Eilonu Miyayim Adin, the comparison to Ani Yosef. They saw that their life, what they did for 22 years, they caused their father, what they did. All of this became clear, what they did, because they made the wrong mistake. And up to then, they didn't realize that they made the wrong mistake. Now, if you looked at somebody that felt this shame and literally saw the world drop out within him, and looking at his countenance, at his face, you could see it very clearly. So this exposure that Yosef saw, if there was, we'll say, any animosity, that sufficed. So when it says here that the brothers couldn't answer, Kinivalo Miponov, so then he immediately said to them, I'm your brothers. And then we could appreciate in sentence 12 when he says, or 5, he says, don't feel bad that you sold me here, because all of this was what? Was God's will. Then he says, in sentence 7, if you'll note, Hashem has sent me here to give you Sheiris Ba'aretz. Now here we see again what we mentioned last week, that at any great moment, the vanity of Yosef had totally disappeared. It's God, just like he told Pharaoh, so here that was God that appointed him. Here also, God had sent me. Now, if you notice sentence 7, what does he say? God had sent me. In sentence 8, he repeats again, God had sent me, correct? In sentence 9, he repeats again, God had appointed me. So in 7, 8, and 9, and specifically in sentence 9, he says, go tell the father, this is what your son Yosef said. So Mani Elakim Leodon, God had appointed me to a master in Egypt. Come to me. So now, what happens? It says a little bit later, that they came, if he's still alive, v'chihu Mosheo b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, and he's a ruler. They left out something. They figured, when are they going to go tell him the whole drasha? So they took the major point. The major point was Yosef is living, and he's a ruler. V'yofik libe, so it says his heart stood still. Ki lahem, because he didn't believe them. So there are two approaches to this. And look at 27. Vaydabru elov es kol divrei Yosef asher dibar aleihem. But they then spoke to him and said, all the words that Yosef told him. What were all the words? The words that they left out the first time. Not that he's an Adon in Mitzrayim, but Somani Elekim Le'odon. So then it says, Vayaris Agolos. The Agolos were also the wagons, the Medrash tells us, the Gemara tells us. Yosef sent specifically these Agolos because this would remind Yaakov that the last topic that they discussed in learning was the law of the Eglo Arufa, of the calf. So Vayaris Agolos, then Vatchi Ruach Yaakov Aviem, again he became alive. So what do you see from here? According to this, that Yaakov's major concern was, is Yosef what? Is Yosef the Yosef? If Yosef was not the Yosef anymore, so then he has nothing really to rejoice, to concern himself with. And then we could appreciate then the last point of the Midrash, that Yaakov Avinu, at this moment, of course, Vayah Yosef, but deep in his mind, it seems, he still had the concern that perhaps Yosef had become influenced in Egypt. And we know how close it was. It said, Vayovo, just one more thing, it says, Vayhi Ayom, Vayovo La Sos Melofto, right? And it said, I'm just, that he saw the countenance of his father, right? The appearance of his father, and that kept him from sin. Now it seems, I spoke at the Yeshiva banquet, I mentioned, it seems that the Torah that he studied, that didn't keep him from sin. It was studying Torah from the spirit of his father. Now when Yaakov Avinu was very concerned that Yosef would say he couldn't stand up against temptation, he realized that all the Torah that one has, but finding oneself in such a circumstance can be tremendous. And he saw you on a tremendous test. And he was almost true. It seems that it was almost true. But the one thing he didn't realize is that Yosef had the Dmus Diyukne Shalava. He had in front of him the picture of Yaakov. And it was not the Torah which Yaakov perhaps, but it was the picture of Yaakov that kept Yosef back. And it was difficult sometimes for Yaakov, we'll say, to appreciate that. Remember I once gave you this one, and I'm going to finish with a story I once read. You remember about the delegation, there was about seeing one's picture, taking a picture, having a mirror. So this tzaddik never looked in a mirror. So he once went with a delegation, and then he saw him coming into the king's palace. They had mirrors. So he looked, he says, who is the angel that's walking with us? A person really can't envision. So Yaakov Avinu probably couldn't envision, we'll say, the strength of that he, or his appearance, would have on Yosef to save Yosef, and therefore he constantly had this in his mind, thinking that could be an approach.